reality is a form of light, and our souls are related with unbreakable wires.
Just to let everybody know, this is the debut episode of Bioluminescence. The idea behind this is basically to explore what it means to be a creative, an artist, provide a service to the world that is kind of intangible. You know, you can put a price on it, you can label it, but in all reality, art especially, you know, music, traditional art, dance, cooking, they're all art forms. They all provide an outlet for people to express themselves in a more non-linear way, I guess. And I think a lot of times artists are judged very artificially. So I'm going to try to take the opportunity to explore, you know, more than what meets the eye of the artistic experience, the connection to an audience, how you got there, what it means to you to be able to do this for people. So I'm going to, you know, for this first episode, I'm going to talk about myself for a little bit, because why not, right? Moving forward, there will be guests. Later in this episode, I will be opening the floor to the audience. Just keep your eyes on the comments. I'll on the Facebook link. And I'll be taking some Zoom calls. I think it'll just be audio, no video. We'll see what happens. I've been having some issues with it. But I want to keep it kind of restrained, constrained within, you know, the current times. Basically, let's just start with, you know, the beginning of 2020, and we'll kind of work our way up to where we are now, whatever that means. When the year started, I found myself in an interesting situation because I knew that I was reaching a point in my career where my options, while they were a little bit more open, they were also kind of closing in certain ways. You know, as you get older, the freedom to try new things or the freedom to make irresponsible decisions gets smaller and smaller. You know, I recently got engaged, and I'll be getting married later this year, which we all know means that little ones usually follow pretty closely behind that. So, you know, you got to start thinking more and more about, you know, your financial responsibilities, your commitments to, you know, your significant other, the people that, you know, rely on you. There's a lot that goes into aging gracefully, I suppose. And so with that, you know, I've been thinking more and more about how art and being an artist can not only be a financial existence, but also still very much a fulfilling existence. And one of the things that kind of got my juices flowing a little bit earlier this year was the concept that I debuted back in March, which is called Modern Mythology. It was basically a way to get back to my roots of why I do this in the first place. You know, just like everybody out there, I started as a fan of music. From the earliest days that I can remember, there was always music playing very loudly. And it's always been the singular most important thing in my life. And I consider myself extremely lucky that I was able to make a living in the music industry and do it on, for the most part, on my terms. But as we all know, you can't just expect things to be there every day when you wake up. And as we all learned back in March, nothing's for certain. So, ironically enough, the concept for modern mythology was actually conceived late last year, but it evolved very quickly when this COVID situation reared its ugly head. Originally, the idea was to explore creating art in a physical medium. It's just a way, just like a new outlet. It's just something different that I could look at and actually be proud of. Because I struggle greatly with how I perceive my performances from as a lighting designer. So it's hard for me to look back on those. And while I know they're impressive and, you know, people, you know, think that I do a good job. And I know I do a good job, but at the same time, I'm my biggest critic. And it really does pain me sometimes to look back, especially, you know, if a few years have gone by, that shit's almost unwatchable to me. So, and that's almost by design. I very much exist in the moment as from a performance standpoint. So it's a really unique presentation because of the mindset that is attached to it. I don't pre-plan everything. I don't dissect every decision and every note and all those things that, you know, a lot of people do, and rightfully so. It's very much, it's like Picasso versus Pollock, or, you know, Da Vinci or whatever. So there's in every medium of art, there are so many different ways to get from point A to point B. For me, it's always been about the spirit of the moment, improvisation, but also keeping it not only fresh and new, but also attached to the circumstances. And what I mean by that is, when I go into a show, when I go into a venue, I try to take the entire presence that's in front of me, and I try to use it to my advantage. So every show that I do, whether it's with Pretty Lights, whether it was with Banks, 30 Seconds to Mars, Break Science, Opio, this person, that person, when I do these shows, I am so unbelievably conscious of the environment. And it really plays a big role in how I approach the visual presentation of a show. So whether it's indoor, whether it's outdoor, whether it's windy, whether the sun's out, this thing, that thing, whether there's a really lively audience, whether the hot dog vendor is 20 feet away from me and he made me hungry because I keep seeing people eating hot dogs, it all affects me. And so with that, the minute the show's over, all of that disappears. So when I move forward, it's impossible to look back because I can't reconstruct all of the circumstances that created those moments in the first place. So what I'm trying to get to is why I decided to get into physical art, but it really does make a difference to me how everything interplays with each other. And through that birthed this desire to create something that 10 years from now I could look back on and really be proud of. So the original concept for modern mythology was to create these artworks based on my mythological heroes. And as an added bonus, the idea originally was to actually record the sessions and then tape them to VHS. And then if you bought all three, or I was gonna, I never thought it completely through, but somehow the secret bonus to buying these prints was actually receiving this VHS with the actual live sessions on them. So when COVID hit, that changed everything, because there's no job to go to, there were no performances, So there was a lot of itches that needed to be scratched. So I decided to evolve it into a performance-based project, but still with the end goal of creating physical artwork. And it was a really, honestly, it probably saved my life during this quarantine, because it was a struggle to really understand what it all meant when it first happened. And I can't imagine what some people were going through that couldn't afford to, you know, put food on their table or take care of their children or any of those things. Like, I consider myself extremely lucky that, you know, financially we do well, and we were able to, you know, manage the situation. But at the same time, it was still extremely difficult. And having this outlet that just kind of bubbled its way up to the surface was a complete lifesaver. And it really also helped me from a joyful standpoint, because working with the artists that I love, that I'll never have an opportunity to work with, you know, you just face facts. I mean, I'll never work with the Grateful Dead. Jerry Garcia is gone, and, you know, Dead and Company's great, but that is what it is. You know, Fish, you know, they have their Corota, and he's not going anywhere anytime soon. And then, you know, obviously I did Derek Pretty Lights, and, you know, and I miss him dearly. You know, it's been almost two years since our last show. And so that was just a way for me to reconnect with that music, because I honestly probably haven't really listened to Pretty Lights, you know, since those last shows at Red Rocks. And those first three performances really, really meant a lot to me. And it meant a lot to me that a lot of you, you know, tuned in and appreciated it and enjoyed it for what it was, because at the end of the day, it was an experiment. It was not polished. It was not pretty. There were technical difficulties. I was all over the place. Some of it was just complete nonsense. But that's the joy of creating, is all of that. You know, you take the good with the bad, and you learn from those experiences. And it was a real pleasure to be able to let people in on the creative process. Because when you're doing a concert, everything is shrouded in secrecy. You want to keep that shit as close to the vest as possible. So that way, when the shows do happen, you get that wow factor right off the bat. If people know what you're going to do, it takes a little bit of the shine off. So with this, it was cool, because you got to see me just stumble my way through something that I really wanted to do. And I don't know if I'll ever, you know, I have a few more artists that I need to cover. I've done 6 out of the 9 muses so far. And this next series, which is dubbed My Generation, will be 3 prolific artists. I guess you could say they're prolific, sort of, from the 90s. 3 of the artists that really, really meant a lot to me in, you know, in my formative years of my late teens, early 20s. And that performance, it's going to be a singular performance, I think. There just isn't as much to pick from as there was with the past artists, which were Jerry Garcia, Trey Anastasio, Derek Vincent Smith, David Gilmour, Bob Weir, and Frank Zappa. All of those artists have tremendous catalogs, tremendous live libraries. So it was really easy to just, like, either A, play a whole show that I loved, or just cherry pick these beautiful moments throughout their careers. They're all longstanding, you know, entities. So that made it really easy to you know, package this all up. These next artists that I'll be doing, one of them very longstanding, the other two not so much. And I'll get into all that down the road once that last series comes out. But so that was a really great time. For a time, it did the trick for close to 2 months, you know. But as all things do, at some point they don't seem as important as they once were. And after that second series, I kind of found myself less motivated, less inspired by the whole thing. It started to feel more like work, and so you step back for a second, find other means to, you know, get creative and hope that you can keep the momentum going without, you know, too much disruption. So this would have been, let's see, I'm trying to think, it's been almost 3 or 4 weeks, I guess, since 3-4 weeks since the last Modern Mythology episode. And then I went about a week, maybe 10 days. It's funny how we think about these things right now, because the last 3 months seem like a lifetime, but it's only been 3 months. And so to think that I feel like I'm looking so far back into the distant past, but it's only been 3 weeks since that last episode, but it feels like an eternity. You know, there was about a week there where I was just done. Just, I had no motivation, no creative outlets. I didn't really want to do anything. And I hate that feeling more than anything in the world. That just, like, the feeling of being lost, I guess. And I can only imagine how many of you out there are feeling that way right now. So I have an innate ability to push myself off cliffs constantly. And so I found a new cliff to jump off of. And what you kind of see behind me is the beginning. This is the trail leading up to the cliff. I am in the process of developing an art installation-ish sort of thing here at Ravine in Atlanta, Georgia, where I manage all the production and all that fun stuff here. And, you know, hopefully sometime soon the doors will be open again and this place will be packed full of crazy people. But until then, I'm going to try to create something special inside these four walls that I hope, you know, will keep the spirit alive. So with that, you know, I took a trip up to Pennsylvania, where the warehouse is located from my laser company, Lightwave International. My best friend, Neil Nance, who many of you probably know, him and I spent a week up there experimenting, exploring, messing around with lasers and cameras and fog waterfalls, all sorts of different things, hanging out with roosters. Rooster. That fucking rooster. It was exactly what I needed. I just needed to take a step out of the bubble and, you know, just clean the slate, so to speak. So I went up there, had an amazing time, and out of that came a new spark. And then just as that trip was winding down, I think, let's see, I believe the riots started on Thursday, and I was there until Sunday. So yeah, so while I was up there, I was getting reports from my fiance about the riots happening in Minneapolis and then happening in Atlanta, where we live. And it was a pretty scary thing to just hear about, because when you're up where we were, you're essentially detached from society. I mean, it's this beautiful compound up on a hillside. You know, the neighbors are a half mile away. It's just beautiful. It's serenity. And to hear that while you're experiencing this peacefulness, your city is on the verge of burning down, it's hard to describe just how fucking crazy that is. And it's hard to describe how crazy all of this is, because you think that society is always moving forward. At least you hope they are. And then every once in a while, we seem to take a giant step back and this is just that most recent step, maybe three steps back. It's the whole thing's ridiculous. But it's really sad. And I found myself, you know, it's a 10, 11 hour drive home. And I just found myself in the car by myself, just losing all the joy that I had just captured over the last week. And, you know, worrying about the safety of my family, my dogs, worrying about what I'm coming home to, worrying about this building that I'm inside. We're right across the street from the Federal Reserve. So not being here, not knowing all the circumstances around what was really going on, you know, your mind starts to wander. It's like, well, shit, if people are protesting, odds are they're going to go to the government buildings. Well, what bigger government building is there in Atlanta than the Federal fucking Reserve? I mean, it's just so, yeah, I mean, I was definitely thinking the worst on a lot of things. When I didn't get the phone call that there was a problem, that definitely, you know, helped, but you just never know with these things. So I get home and I see how it's just escalating, and the anger is building and the resentment is building towards the government, towards the police, towards these people who, for whatever reason, can't accept the fact that we as a society have a major issue. It's really sad because there's a tremendous amount of ignorance going on around us. And for as forward-thinking as so many of us are, there are so many people that just choose to stay put and cannot accept progress in so many levels. And being a kid from New York who then lived in Denver for 10 years, two very extremely progressive cultures, and then to move to Atlanta where there is this great divide between a black culture that thrives but also struggles, a very, very conservative, old-fashioned, you know, I don't want to say white demographic, but like, I don't know what else to say there. And then you have this birth of this new artistic cultural presence here in Atlanta. So many people were, I don't know if they still are anymore, but there were so many people coming to Atlanta. It was almost in a weird way, the new Denver. There were so many people moving to this city and building up this new spirit that Atlanta should be. Forward-thinking people, people of acceptance. Skin color is just that. It's just skin color. To judge somebody, to ignore the fact that people are being judged by their skin color is just, it is just unacceptable. And I found myself really struggling with it and really struggling with the state of this country for the first time in my entire life. When you are fortunate enough, as I am, to get to travel the world with your friends and do the thing that you love more than life itself, you lose sight of some things. It's just the way it is. And for me, I pretended like the real world didn't exist. I was Peter Pan in Neverland, and I loved every second of it, and who wouldn't? To be able to escape all the darkness the world has to offer and provide light for people. The whole basis of this podcast is that right there. Escape the darkness, provide light. I mean, I've been able to do that for close to two decades now, and I'm honored to do so. And for the first time, I haven't been able to, and I am bearing witness to all the darkness, all the sadness, and it got to me. So I made a video that I released earlier this week called Surreal Radio. It was cathartic, to say the least. It was challenging. It was completely out of character, and I'm so very proud that I did it. The music, the song, Surreal Radio, was written by my dear friends, The Breakfast, Tim Palmieri specifically, whom I toured with before my time with Pretty Lights. And one day, not that long ago, I was just randomly listening to the song, and I could not believe how powerfully in tune it was with the times. And this song was written 15, 16 years ago. It's a fictional story about a dictator. It's Star Wars and outer space for hippies. That's it. But those words ring so true to what we're dealing with right now. And I just, for whatever reason, couldn't let it go. So I reached out to Tim and I asked him if I could use the song for something. I didn't tell him what I was going to do. I didn't share this with anybody except for one person. One person whose opinions I respect dearly. And even then, it was very, very much bits and pieces. And I really just, I wanted to get it out there unedited. I didn't want any insight from anybody else. I didn't really want it to be critiqued. I didn't care if it was good or bad. The only thing that I cared about was that it conveyed all the anger, all the sadness, all the disappointment that I've been feeling as of late, and has much of this country has been feeling. And so I don't really know what people's impressions are of it, because from the handful of people that I've spoken to about it, many of them essentially were rendered speechless by it, whether it's because it came from me, whether it's because it was what it was, I don't know, but I haven't received a lot of feedback on it. And that's why I wanted to start this podcast off by talking to you guys out there. I'm hoping some of you have seen it that are tuning in right now. If you haven't, I'd be honored if you would. And I'll drop this Zoom link here in a few minutes. I still have a few things I'd like to go over before I open the floor to you guys. But it's a weird existence that we are all experiencing simultaneously. So if you feel like you're alone in this, you're not. We're all in the same boat. Some of us are doing better than others. You know, some of us still have our jobs. Some of us have loved ones to take, you know, to take care of us. But at the end of the day, we're all in this together. And we have to support each other in any way that we can. Whether it's a phone call, whether it's a Zoom call, whether it's a text message, whether it's a happy birthday shout out from the street in your car. The creativity that I've witnessed personally from my small group of friends down here has been pretty remarkable. And, you know, there's always hope to be had, and there's always joy to be had. And I hope that we don't lose sight of that. And I hope that no matter how bleak things seem to be, that we all remember to have a smile on our face at least some of the time. And I know it's hard right now, but we'll get through this, and hopefully we all get off our asses in November and vote that monster out of office. And I'll leave it at that, I guess. Let's see. Oh, I forgot to go live on Instagram, I guess. Oh, well. Yeah, fuck it. Jesus. Let's see here. So I'm going to drop this link in the comments here, And I'll give it a few minutes, and I'm gonna ramble on about a few other things that have been on my mind, and then we'll open up the floor to some folks. So give me one second here. All right. While I'm doing this, I would like to give a special shout out to Tim Palmieri, the man who wrote Surreal Radio. We've been speaking more in these last few months than we have in quite some time. And that really, you know, it really means a lot to me to reconnect with him. We lived together in the beginning of the Breakfast days, and we went through a lot of interesting experiences together. And, you know, he's like a brother to me. And he, you know, he's been having some issues with his vocal cords and has been playing like an animal for people on a semi-regular basis on these different live streams. And some of them, I think, are instrumental. I don't get to watch them all. He plays so often. But he is truly one of the most talented, profound, prolific artists I've ever met, experienced, seen. And I hope one day the rest of the world understands and respects his genius the way that I do. Until then, I'm going to keep doing goofy shit with him in hopes that it will help. All right, let's see. I'm so bad at the internet. Let's see. Here we go. Here we go. This is the one. Whoa. Well. There we go. All right, so I've just dropped the link in the comments there with the password. And I'll just, you know, keep this rolling while I wait for some of you guys to hop on. While I'm waiting for some people here, one of the things that I'd like to also talk about is, other way, what's going on here behind me. One of the fun things of this podcast. I promise you they won't all be this somber and serious. First off, I'm a pretty happy, jovial person, and I like to be a goofball. And I thought it would be great to kind of provide some counterpoint to all of this seriousness by playing what is perhaps the most incredible children's television programming of all time. And this will be a thematic thing moving forward on every episode of Bioluminescence. I will be playing a random, obscure, weird movie or collection of content from my very vast VHS collection. And for this first episode, I could think of nothing better than the wonderful world of Sid and Marty Krofft. Some of you may know who Sid and Marty Krofft are. For those of you who don't, they were psychedelic pioneers of children's programming in the late 60s and early 70s. They made more stuff past that, but like the meat and potatoes, the stuff that really matters, H.R. Puff and stuff, the Electric Lady, or Electric Woman, Sigmund and the Sea Monster, all that stuff, 65 to 75, somewhere in that range. This right here is true magic. And if you've never experienced the greatness of Sid and Marty Krofft, there's tons of it on YouTube. You don't have to buy a VHS to watch it. Please, if you're feeling down, this will lift you back up. I guarantee it. So, I said my piece. I hope you guys appreciate me opening up to you, just kind of giving you some insight into where you know I was coming from, because You know, I had a few people be like, dude, that's not what we want from you. You're the happy person who provides a distraction. And you know, sometimes even the happy guy has to be a little angry, and it's hard to hide it, so. Apparently you guys can't hear Ian, but he just asked me how I got my start in lighting. And basically, my best friend, Phil Salvaggio, who I still to this day work with, and he had a band in high school. He's an amazing guitar player. I see he's been playing with his guitars again as of late, which is very exciting. But I was a very lost person out of high school. I went to a college that I shouldn't have gone to. I was doing all sorts of stupid shit, and I would just go to his shows and just go to have fun. And he at some point was just like, dude, if you're just gonna be here, you might as well make yourself useful. So maybe you should just like run the lights or whatever. And we're talking about, you know, a bar band playing 200 people or whatever. But so I was like, all right, cool, sure, whatever. Like, if I can keep getting drunk, I'll do the lights. Why not? So I can't remember where the first show was. It might have been, no, I think it, I don't know. It doesn't matter which where the first show was. It was so long ago and it was so random. But you know, it was just like pushing these buttons and just making like little like Parcan lights just turn on and off. And we quickly realized that I had really, really, really good timing. And I loved it. I was like, this is the funnest thing ever. It's like playing a video game to your friend's music. Like, this is the coolest shit. And so I dropped out of college and was just like, all right, I guess this is what I'm doing now. And it was supposed to be a temporary thing. It was supposed to just be me fucking off for a little while until I kind of figured out what I wanted to do next. I never, never approached it as like, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. That never even crossed my mind at first. And it wasn't until a couple years later where I moved to Connecticut to work with Psychedelic Breakfast, or The Breakfast as they're known now. And that's when it all kind of clicked, and I was like, maybe this can be a job. Now, granted, while I toured with The Breakfast, I made $20 a day, so I was by no means, you know, financially successful, but I treated that time like my college. And it was probably the greatest time of my life, just in the sense of like for any college kid, for like the first 2 years, I guess, right? Like, there's a certain sense of like carelessness and freedom. You're finally out of the house. Like, the classes are still relatively easy. So you could just kind of like, you know, you have some responsibility, but at the end of the day, you're just getting wasted and having fun with your friends. And nobody can yell at you when you get home. So it started innocently enough until it all of a sudden wasn't so innocent anymore. And I just learned as much as I could. I started working at a venue in Connecticut, in New Haven, called Toad's Place, which exposed me to some larger acts, some other lighting designers. I met my good friend Andy Cass there way back in like 2005, while he was the tech for Modest Yahoo. He was probably my first like lighting connection for somebody who I still talk to this day. Back in those days, I was still, especially for that venue, it was a lot of like legend acts. So a lot of older bands that were kind of on the decline. And so with those bands generally comes older LDs who've been with the band for 20 years or whatever. So those guys wouldn't give me the time of day. And then Andy was probably the first person. And then 5 years went by before we ever spoke again, or maybe not that long, but it was very sparse. But it was around that time when I started to really take it seriously. and was pushing myself to figure out how to actually be successful. Because it's one thing to do all these shows and to learn, but it's another thing to make a good paycheck, have your own voice, and really stand out of the pack. And it's just time and effort, and yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, I got you now.
Okay.
Sorry about that, everyone out there. My audio settings were a little screwed up, but I think we got it figured out. Anyway, all right, so let's bring that question back so the whole audience can hear.
Sure thing. So your stage design has kind of progressed like a story over the past. One of my favorite motifs to be in the boxes of like the Analog Future Band being flipped upside down for PLI and being used as LED screens. Are there any other stage devices you've used like similarly that we wouldn't have caught on to with the naked eye?
That's a tricky one because I think the motif, the overarching motif of Pretty Lights is progression, right? We're constantly trying new things. Now, subtle things may find their way back in. I mean, gosh, I guess like the laser cage would probably be the most, because it's evolved over the last, whatever, I don't know when it was debuted, 4 years ago maybe now. So it maybe existed for 2 or 3 years of actual shows. I think that one has kind of been the most, in recent memory anyway, has been the most, there's been the most focus put on that one to keep it fresh and new, but also keep it within the show. Because more often than not, I try to actually leave things behind. There are color schemes maybe for certain songs, but even that changes. I will say that the shows in 2018 at Red Rocks was kind of an homage to as many ideas as possible. So like dusting off old content that hadn't been played in years, taking the towers, mirror imaging them, just a lot of like little things, from like the way the stage was lit, stuff like that. So I tried my best to kind of encapsulate all of the most important aspects of the of the past rigs, minus probably, I guess, the spheres, the video balls. I hated those things.
For those 2015 or 2014.
I don't know. It doesn't matter, but
yeah.
back in those days, you know, and I got to give credit to Dave Najarian, because in the early days of Pretty Lights, him and I worked on a lot of this stuff together. Him, myself, and Derek. You know, it was kind of, there was like a team effort for a good chunk of that time, and then, you know, it ebbed and flowed as far as whose ideas kind of rose to the surface, you know, depending on each different iteration. And then, like, you know, in the debut of the live band, that was the no video tour, and like that was all me, except for like the sun concept. Like Derek and I kind of worked on that whole thing to get the disco ball with the thing around it.
Yeah, did you like hit with a big yellow?
Yeah,
like
that was the color map of the sun. Like goofy stage presentation of that. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until like, you know, Dave left in 2016 or 2015, I think, and then it was very much Derek and I working on this stuff, and then towards the end, it basically is just me just kind of throwing ideas at the wall until they and seeing which ones stuck. But I kind of like what I was saying in the beginning of the podcast, I don't know if you heard, but it's like, it's really hard for me to look back on those things, for a multitude of reasons, but I really, especially now with us taking this break for as long as we have and not knowing when the return is going to be, I really, really, really want to focus on leaving almost all of that behind and just almost starting with a clean slate. And just bringing a whole new presentation. It'll still feel like a Pretty Light show, and it'll still look like a Pretty Light show. It's just going to be different. That's all. So,
I love it. Yeah. Fuck everything. Let's go.
Yeah, right.
So Andy Watts and CK5, big influences for you.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any, like, I know the analog's so much more creative and like in the fly and in the moment, but are there any like analog artists that you look towards that you use for like inspiration or influence?
For,
I know the guy that does Tom's like Tomorrow Modern Boxes, his name starts with a T.
Oh, yeah, Tariq, I think.
Yeah, Tariq Mali or something.
So, funny story about that. What Tariq's doing is an analog, actually. It is a custom piece of software that he developed, like, 10 years ago, and it's evolved over these last 10 years. But it's, like, some weird, wacky... I saw this, like, TED Talk that he did a few years ago, because I thought it was analog the first time he was with Tom. Right. And I was like, holy shit, somebody else is doing this, like, in front of a real crowd. Like, this is amazing. And then I did a little research, and I found out that he wasn't. It was, like, just wild, like, live, generative, computer-based thing. Now, he may have some analog stuff built in with it now. I don't know how it's evolved, because, honestly, that shit is so way over my head. Like,
it's just wicked.
It's incredible. It's so incredible. But, yeah, it's really special because it's his. He coded it. I think he worked with one other person to basically develop this software. And he's actually more known for his like art installations than he is for live performance. Tom discovered him through some crazy thing that he did and was like, "Hey, you want to come play these shows with me?" And he's like, "Yeah, sure." And so, he's not a traditional touring designer the way the rest of us are. And I think that's one of the special things about him is that he took a unique set of talents that don't really exist in the touring world and figured out a way to make it work. And it shows in how very just mind-blowing and unique that presentation is.
Yeah, it's super unique. it's similar. The reason I even like bring him up is because like, it is in that same vein of
It's very similar. Like conceptually, it's very similar. But from the actual application standpoint, they're actually quite different. I am trying to introduce some digital live generation into my process, but it's a challenge because this thing is so hands on that it makes it hard to kind of take yourself away from it, and I'm trying to find ways to streamline, and that's why I'm constantly like I was saying with the Modern Mythology, a big part of that was just experimenting so that way I can find better ways to do it moving forward when there is an audience in front of me again.
When you say better, do you mean more like compressed or more like
better is a loose word,
right?
It could be better visually, it could be better systemically. Just as far as like workflow goes, very often I get a little lost in it all, and I'm trying to simplify the process, but also be able to replicate the process, because for every Pretty Light show that I've done, it's completely different. I actually patch it during the openers. And so I have a live camera running with a monitor at front of house. And I patch it live during the openers for that set. So I basically set it up however I'm feeling that day, however the cameras are taking in the light that day. And so that's why it was so unique, because it was literally a different setup every night.
That's fucking insane.
You know shit.
Yeah, that is fucking nuts, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every show, you just
every
come
show.
In and
I
just...
would, yeah, I we would set it up during the day, because the thing is like, especially like when we were doing like the episodic things, right? Like you do your sound check and everything, the sun's still up, so you can't see the lights, so the cameras are completely different during the day than they are at night, and the live camera stuff is such a big part of what makes all of this special, and so I would have to wait until it got dark, and so the best ever was, this is one of my favorite memories of this, was... Because, we've had a lot of different openers over the years. But when we did the Gorge and Sound Tribe opened for us. And so I'm actually running a video show for myself during Sound Tribe set that nobody could see.
videos, the soundtrack, basically.
Well, and well, but I was getting it set up for the pre-light show that night, and that's why that, like, you know, from my memory, that, like, that show was, stood out. Like, the video stood out, I feel like, a little bit more than some of the other shows, because I was, like, so engaged with their set. And so I'm back here as if I'm running video for Soundtribe, except I wasn't. I was just getting it ready for the Pretty Light Show.
Just running back-to-back, basically, shows.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, the videos, the video, visuals for that show were actually particularly insane.
Yeah.
That actually leads me into my next question. I won't keep it too long. I know there's other people waiting. But during the time off, you know, from PL, you've, like, headed up the Ravine, and you've toured with acts that you could be considered outside of, like, our standard scene.
Sure.
I mean, jam electronic. If the time off continues, and I'm not asking anything about that, but would you consider doing, like, one-off performances with other bands more associated with, you know, what we're used to, similar to what you did with SDS9 over New Year's Eve?
Absolutely. The tricky part about that, though, is that our scene is the only, it's the only portion of live music that is committed to their crew. The jam band and the EDM scene, when you hire somebody and you develop that that relationship, it lasts. Whereas, like, in the pop world and in the rock world, lighting guys come and go constantly. And so,
right.
And so to be able to do a one-off performance means one of two things. Either the light guy got fired or he's taking the night off. And either of those situations don't happen very often. You know, right. My relationship with Soundtribe started because Saxton Waller had to take a week off for some personal, you know, reasons, and I got the call, and I was very honored to do so, and I'm so glad that, because of, you know, very unfortunate circumstances, that I now have a great relationship with that band, and Tiberius is doing a great job, and I had a blast doing a show with him. And, you know, I hope that we can do that again sometime, because that's, like, the rare occurrence where we can coexist. I've broached that topic with Johnny from the Biscuits. There was actually some talk about me potentially being a part of Camp Bisco this year. We never actually landed on anything specific, but the conversation was being had. So, you know, there are times where it may happen, but my phone's always on, so yeah. You know, we'll see what happens.
We'd love to see it. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Trey, man, it's been good talking with you. I hope you're doing well.
Absolutely, man.
I'm gonna get Brett on here, because I know he's got some shenanigans to say to me.
For sure. One compliment really quick. Dude, yeah. Surreal Radio was so cool.
Thank you very much, man.
It was
Thank
very
you.
Abrasive, and, like, I think that whatever you wanted it to be was exactly what it was.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much.
See you around, man.
All right. Cheers, brother.
Cheers.
All right. Let's see. Brett, you're up next, buddy.
So, what he was saying, and it's funny, actually, I was thinking about this time, was it the Fillmore? Denver, 2011, I'm pretty sure.
Jesus Christ, you're going all the way back there?
Yeah, we're going to go back. And that night, you were wearing a Deadmau5 shirt, I'm pretty sure. We were standing by the soundboard.
So, okay, yes. That was just Phil and I being jerks. I think we went to, like, Hot Topic or something, and, like, Deadmau5 had just blown up. And I was like, you got to be fucking kidding me. I can't believe there's a Deadmau5 shirt at Hot Topic. I'm buying this.
Dude, I was like, I'm pretty sure this guy likes the Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
And I was like, but Deadmau5?
It was just a joke. I mean, we were just fucking around. That's, you know.
All right, so over your left shoulder, over that way, like, you got Mickey Mouse, Fantasia.
Oh, yeah.
You got that way, that shit over there. So was it Derek that introduced you into the analog synthesis?
Of course. Derek introduced me to the very first thing that Derek introduced me to, because going back to what I was talking about earlier, where, you know, for a long time, Dave Najarian was the mastermind behind the video show. You know, I did the lights, he did the video. Yeah. And when Dave moved on, I felt like I could handle all of it. But it was one of those situations where, you know, you're presented with a situation and you have two options. You either take the unknown option or you handle it yourself. And I wasn't prepared to bring somebody new into the mix. And I can't speak for Derek, but I don't think that he was either. So it just seemed like we could just do it on our own. And I didn't know shit about video 4 years ago. And
VHS.
And originally, the first iterations of like the video show that Derek and I were kind of putting together were very linked and unlinked simultaneously. He was very big into filming the world. And a lot of that content that you saw, like in 2015-16, Derek filmed himself, or he filmed with his drone crew. Yep. And that became part of the show. And then I tried to take that concept and make it more ambiguous. So I would set up these light sculptures and film those and then affect them. And so basically, you know, taking all these real world things, you know, Derek's filming the sun and cityscapes and nature and all of his experiences that he's seeing. And then I'm filming the light shows that I'm producing, but then being able to manipulate them and then represent them in a new way. And it worked to a degree. But I never really felt that great about it, primarily because we just didn't do it good enough.
I'll say sometimes, like, you know, to do what you're doing, it's hard to do it, but like what you're doing, you have to present it in front of like a huge body of people.
Yeah.
You know, like you don't really have the opportunity to like present that in this huge atmosphere of a lot of people, you know what I mean? And like, that's a big part of it, you know?
Yeah. Well, the biggest thing I think that was like a hindrance for us was that there was too many things happening, too much, you know, fun, too much this, too much that, whatever. And so we kind of half-assed it for a little while, because if you're going to bring in photorealistic content and these very like tangible visual elements, they have to be done with respect and with time. Video is such, I'm working on a music video right now that is so time consuming, but I have the time to do it now. Whereas, and this is a 4 minute music video. This 4 minute music video I've been working on for 3 weeks now. And I'm not even near done, right? We would film shit, chop it up, and just throw it on a video wall and be like, yeah, it's cool. You know, so that was where it was like, all right, we need to go in a new direction. So Derek handed me this analog glitch box, basically, that had RCA inputs on it. And I was like, what the fuck am I supposed to do with this? It's RCA. He's like, oh, just get an adapter. It's fine. And like, you know, like I had like a home stereo when I was younger and stuff. So like I at least understand like signal flow on a very basic level. Well, at that time anyway, right? Like I knew that like HDMI doesn't go into RCA, like analog digital, oh, no. But like I didn't know anything about any of it. So he handed me this box, and he gave me this little modular box that had like a couple of things in it. And he was like, because originally, the original idea actually was to actually manipulate the lights. He had these little DMX interfaces that took CV in. So then like his audio could actually like manipulate things on the console, but it didn't work that well. So I took it home. It was after New Year's. It was after we did the waterfall in New Orleans, and for like 3 months, I just like this was just like blinders on. I'm going to figure this out. And like, before I knew it, I discovered this whole new world of creativity. And the beautiful thing about it is, it all happens in the moment, the same way that I run my light show, the same way that I run my laser show. And so it was the perfect complement to everything that I had been doing for the last 15 years. I had finally found the missing link,
to like finally bring it all together under one roof, under one mindset. And then obviously, you know, introducing in a more advanced way the live camera systems, where we don't have to sit in a studio and edit content for fucking 3 months before a tour. We don't, just don't even have to think about it.
Everything. The infinite, man. Like, honestly, going to shows and seeing what you guys have been doing, like, when you had the camera and it became, like, on the screen, the infinite, like...
Oh, yeah, the feedback loop. Yeah, that's just pointing a camera. That's just... If you have a camera that's plugged into a TV and you point the camera at the TV, that's what happens. But
it's
then
like
it's
when
like
you hold a mirror up against a mirror.
Yeah. You know so I mean? Yeah, you're just creating creating an infinity pool. But like, it's how you do it that makes it interesting and special, and like how the lights interact with it. And that was like, those were the really like special moments for me, was when like I could get a grasp of how it was all working together. And that's one of the reasons why I felt like I could do it on my own, because I'm such an explorer. It's really hard to explore with another person under those circumstances. Word. Right? Like if you have a plan going in and you have a system and all these things, checks and balances, if you will, then the team mentality works. But if you're just out there just floating in the breeze and just trying to catch leaves as you go by, it's really hard to do with somebody else. And so, you know, I thank Derek greatly for having faith in me that I can do the entire show on my own. And I'm so very...
So, Phil's, like, going to school in Fort Collins. I'm pretty sure he, like, hits you up, and he's like, yo, I met this dude, he's crazy, but you could probably do some shit out here.
Yeah, that's exactly how it started.
And, like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. And, like, for real, man, like, and like, I mean, like you said, you're like, yo, back in the day, like, me and Phil, we were going to, like, fish shows, basically, like, you know, and, like, what was it, Toads? Was that the name?
That was
one of,
that was
like,
the venue that I worked at, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I mean, Phil moved to Colorado while I was in Connecticut. That was, like, our little, like, separation period. And he knew I was struggling in New Haven, because I had been there for 4.5 years, and I still wasn't really making any money, and the breakfast was kind of in turmoil, and I just wasn't really sure where I was going to go next, and the timing of everything, it just worked out. He was like, this guy's about to blow up, you should come out here and just take a chance. So I threw all my shit in a van one day and just drove out to Colorado and took a chance. Yeah.
Fort Collins, bitches, for right. Real, man. Like,
absolutely.
Dude, and like, so like, I don't know if you saw that like animation I did for Minert shit, like, you
yeah.
know what I mean? Like,
oh, that shit's beautiful. Dude, I pre-ordered the album, by the way. Thanks, Michael. I love that
dude,
record.
Michael, all day.
That's
you
right.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
If they're Pretty Lights, the name wouldn't be the name if it wasn't for Michael. And like, you know, his parents, like, they, you know, they broke out of Poland and like showed up in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Oh, that's crazy. I mean,
and what was it like? At a skate park, I'm pretty sure is where they met. Like,
yeah,
you know
maybe.
What I mean? Like,
but yeah, boom. I mean, you know, life's a crazy thing, and you know, fate, if you believe in it or not, you know, or happenstance. There's so many different ways. So many different ways you can look at it. But really, what it comes down to is like, if you know, if you're meant to be somewhere, you'll get there. And it's just, you know, having the perseverance to find your way there. But listen, Brett, Zoom's about to kick me off, and I'm going to wrap this podcast up
all
here.
All the love.
It's good to hear from you, buddy. I'll talk to you soon, all right?
Word.
All right, cheers, brother. So with all of that being said, I'm going to wrap this podcast up. Thank you for listening. I want to end on a serious note. I started on a serious note. I should end on a serious note. I know that, you know, this country is facing a lot of issues right now. And there is a lot of attention being directed towards the Black Lives movement, and rightfully so. But there is a part of me that is worried about the ramifications that all of the energy being put towards that is going to affect
the situation that we were in before that. This quarantine COVID thing, it's not just going away. And if anything, it's probably going to get worse because of everything that's going on. And I just, you know, I want to remind everybody out there that there are a lot of people struggling to survive both scenarios. And, you know, donate to whatever cause means the most to you, or donate to as many causes as you can. But let's not forget about your local artists, your local venues that are truly struggling. A lot of the government support that's in place right now doesn't save your live music venues. And without these places, the exchange of art and happiness will be affected greatly as we move forward. So do whatever you can to help support, you know, your local venues, your local artists. Let's keep joy alive, especially during these dark times. And my next guest on my next guest for Bioluminescence is tentatively going to be Adam Deitch of Lettuce and Break Science fame. And that episode will air in probably a couple of weeks. And I just want to say thank you to everybody who tuned in, and talk to you soon.